Okay, first of all, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I'm not sure I'm the most natural person to invite to this kind of an occasion because I'm not a student of either Popper or of Agassiz. But I have to say that, in a sense, I've sort of discovered them over the course of my career. In fact, for those of you who don't know much about where I'm coming from and who I am or anything like that, my PhD is in history and philosophy of science from the University of Pittsburgh, so, you know, positivism's last stand. And under those, in that kind of a context, the whole Popperian tradition was always seen under a cloud of suspicion, perhaps even a greater cloud of suspicion than Kuhn was seen, okay? Because in a sense, they could understand Kuhn. But Popper and people who followed Popper, including Lakatos, were always seen kind of in some in-between zone, where they kind of seemed to be analytic but weren't quite, and they actually, in a sense, the Popperians have always kind of lived up, I think, to the idea of history and philosophy of science as a kind of unified field, where in a sense it's not just a sum of the parts, but it's something that's larger than either history or philosophy left to its own devices. And I think for my teachers this was a very difficult thing to understand, but as someone who came into philosophy trying to understand the nature of humanity, and so I'm glad this was raised in the introductory remarks about me, this has always been a kind of very overriding concern, and that the reason why one might focus on science and focus on knowledge is because, in a sense, our humanity is very much defined by those kinds of things. It may not have started that way, but it has turned out to be kind of the brand under which we sail. And so it becomes very important that what, you know, we take to be knowledge and what we take to be science is important in our society. And it's in this context that I want to talk about the idea of post-truth. But before I get to that, I want to say something about the context of this conference and about Agassiz in particular. Because I have to say, as with a lot of things I get myself into, I didn't know fully what I was doing. And this includes this conference. And so one of the things that I hadn't realized was that, first of all, there was some connection between the fact that there was this translation of Hebrew translation of Popper's Logic of Scientific Discovery and Agassiz's 90th birthday, and the fact that he translated the book, okay? And if you want to know, as someone who nowadays is talking a lot about transhumanism and how human beings can extend their lives productively and indefinitely, this is a standing example of this, if anything is, okay? So let me say that at the outset. Okay, you can applaud if you want. And because I do think that and also the other thing that I found very striking, and again, I was completely surprised, and you people should be ashamed of yourself, that this is the first conference in Israel devoted to him. I mean, I would have thought that if any place should appreciate this guy is here. Okay, I can understand why he has enemies all over the world, okay, so we won't go into that. But the point is, I would have thought that this is the place that should honor this man, especially in the totality of his achievements, given that it's already been alluded to in the introductory remarks by the other speakers. But really, come on. I mean, what is this country about? I mean, this man in a way epitomizes what's good about this country, okay? So I really do want to put that on the table, because I don't know if anyone else is going to say it, and maybe it's difficult to say it for people who come from this country, but for someone who's an outsider, I'm happy to say it, okay? And so I want that on the record right now. Now, the other thing I would say, too, is that one of the things that I think is really striking about Agassiz's work. And in this way, more so than Popper, actually, and this goes to the issue of style that Natty was raising at the beginning, is that it is, in a way, it exemplifies the kind of thing Popper talked a lot about, but in a way only exemplified every so often, and that is a kind of straightness, directness, conciseness, making the point, you know, once, making it clearly, and then letting people do what they will with it. And the thing that I find very striking, and it's a real indictment of universities today, is how this falls on deaf ears. Okay? So in other words, if you actually talk this way and you actually write this way, you get nowhere. Right? So there are all these books, and yet they should be having much more impact. And why don't they have the impact? And of course, you can say some of this is due to personality. Okay? I'm not going to deny this, and again, I don't want to bring this up. But the point is, not all of it can be due to personality. right? There is a sense in which the way in which we accredit knowledge claims, right, the way in which we evaluate stuff, to even begin at the outset to think that this is something that might be true or might be reasonable, that we might want to assess or think about more deeply, is very much colored by the way it's initially presented to us, right? And we do sort of expect at the outset, as part of the opening offer, that it has a certain level of complexity and difficulty and learnedness and so forth. But if that's the way we're going to go with regard to the presentation of knowledge claims, then it's going to be very difficult to talk about democratization. Right, there's going to be a sense in which what part of what the academy needs to do in terms of its self-presentation is to strip down, right, is in a sense to make it, you know, to sort of, you know, remove a lot of the scholarly armament and so forth, that at the moment actually serves primarily as a blockage to people actually being able to engage with our concepts and our claims in a reasonable fashion, okay? And so from that standpoint, I would say that Agassiz is actually providing a very good example that more people actually need to adopt. So people get used to this mode of self-presentation. Because from my standpoint, more than even the content of the claims that he makes is actually the style. And the style is actually the thing that, in a sense, more people need to adopt. And let me put this in a certain kind of context for you. We live in a world, as you all know, where the internet is the primary mode by which knowledge claims are being produced and distributed and evaluated and so forth. And there's a sense in which that for every knowledge claim that's out there, there is a register, there is a level at which people can interact with it. And that is one of the reasons why a lot of the established forms of epistemic authority in society today is being challenged, right? Because in a sense, you don't have to listen to the medical mumbo jumbo. You can get a much simpler story, and then you can decide for yourself whether you believe what the doctor says or not. Okay, and this is happening across the board increasingly, and so the whole idea of as it were, kind of bulldozing people with scholarly apparatus, with complexity, with technical language, and so forth, is having less of its charm, less and less charm than it's ever had, and insofar as universities only defend themselves on the basis that, you know, they can turn you into a producer of elite knowledge, they're going to lose that battle in the long run, okay? The university has to be for some other kind of reason. And I think actually Agassiz provides a kind of very useful way to think about what it is that the university can provide, and in terms of manner of self-presentation, excellent example, because he doesn't talk about trivial stuff. It's not like, you know, he's talking about the most difficult stuff that everybody else is talking about, right? From Einstein to psychoanalysis, whatever. But the point is, he's not doing it in a way that makes it impossible for you to feel that you could have anything to say unless you've already got a PhD. And so I think this is a real, you know, if you want, you know, what is the take-home lesson of this man's life? I would have thought this is it, and this is something that I have not seen, actually, you know, in terms of the people who I have studied with or encountered, especially of his generation, okay? And so I do think this is something worth bearing in mind. You know, regardless of what you think about the particular views that he holds on particular issues, the style is really important here. And it's going to be more and more important because, as I say, with the age of the internet, hiding behind elite forms of knowledge isn't going to cut it, right? It isn't going to cut it in the long run. You're going to be retreating more and more if you do that. You're not going to be part of any kind of democratizing process. So this is something for academics, I think, to think about with regard to what it is the legacy of this man, okay? So I'll just begin with that as a kind of opening set of remarks because I figure this is exactly the setting to say something like this to. But this is not what I'm here to talk about. in fact, what I want to talk about is post-truth. And this is something, as was mentioned in the opening remarks, that I am completing a book on. It should be out early next year, and it's called Post-Truth, Knowledge is a Power Game. I want to say something about post-truth, because I think in terms of the general Popperian disposition toward truth, which has always been kind of a curious one, I think one would say from the standpoint of philosophy, post-truth poses a very interesting issue. And maybe this is something that we can discuss in more detail. The first thing I would say is that, as you may know, post-truth really became an important concept in English in 2016 when it was made the Oxford English Dictionary Word of the Year. Okay, and this was in light of Brexit which and Trump's election in the United States, and neither of these things were expected, and they both of them overturned established opinion. And the interesting thing is, and the term post-truth was being used to characterize the campaigns in both cases. Now, the interesting thing at the outset is what exactly the Oxford English Dictionary says post-truth is. Basically, what let's put it this way: it's certainly not a definition from the standpoint of anyone who might be sympathetic to the idea of post-truth. Right? Post-truth is clearly cast as a pejorative notion, and it's basically you know, people who hold beliefs and make claims on the basis of emotions rather than reason and evidence. That's basically what the Oxford English Dictionary tells you post-truth is. And that this is some sense given legitimacy, in the sense that it should not be given legitimacy. Now it seems to me that what I would say, and this is where it gets kind of interesting, is that what we have here with the Oxford English Dictionary's definition of post-truth is a post-truth definition of post-truth. Well, no, because what I want to draw attention to is the fact that what post-truth is doing. In a way, is not, it is displacing the notion of truth, but because it is moving to the meta level, okay? And this is when I talk about, you know, knowledge is a power game. Namely, if you control the terms of engagement, if you control the language in which things are being, in which knowledge claims are being produced and disseminated and so forth, then in a sense, you've already won at least half the battle, okay? And part of one of the things that is very characteristic of both the Brexit campaign and the Trump campaign, and they both kind of work together, and nowadays, of course, people think Russia was involved and all the rest of it, is the fact that what was going on here wasn't as simple as you know, people providing fake news or saying false things and so forth. But rather, actually changing the frame within which news was being perceived, right, and in which facts were being produced, and this is the interesting issue, right? So there was a meta level change going on, that in a sense the rules of the game were changing, and people hadn't realized it, and the experts were sort of imagining that in fact, you know, the way people see the world is pretty much as we see the world, and so we're sort of instructing them as to what to believe, what not to believe, and so forth. That there was this kind of almost like epistemic chain of command that came from the experts, whether they be the academy or they be the government or whatever, and people then are supposed to, you know, fall into line. But in fact, what we saw in these two campaigns, and what makes it very interesting from a post-truth perspective, was that in fact the frame of the game had changed, right? That in a sense, what these guys succeeded in doing was not to convince necessarily people of stuff that was false, but rather changing the terms in which people were seeing things. So that seeing the things that would have looked like as bad or false in one frame now looked okay in another frame, and people continue to believe them. And in fact, these beliefs have stuck quite a lot, actually, in the sense that even now that we know, let's say, the negative consequences that are likely to follow from Brexit and the negative consequences that I think Americans are seeing every day with regard to Trump's presidency, the core support for both of these things remains very solid. Okay, they remain very solid. So there's a sense in which, you know, one has to think about what exactly is going on here, right? And this challenges a lot of our conceptions at many different levels. It seems to me, it challenges not only the terms in which we talk about truth and falsehood, but it also challenges what our values are in terms of what we think is important to stress and not to stress as being the most important thing. And it obviously challenges the modes of authority, because nowadays people are very comfortable, in fact increasingly comfortable, you know, dismissing experts when they hear that they are presented as experts. Okay? This was not so much so true before. But now, you know, if you present yourself, look, I'm someone who actually knows about how the economy works, I'm someone who actually knows how this works, that's actually grounds for people to dismiss you. And I think one of the ways in which you see this is the what I would say is the rhetorical undermining of the idea of the consensus. Okay? One of the things that have been that had been very important as a kind of rhetorical device, you might say, by which both academic authorities and political authorities have sort of colluded together to present a kind of united front in the way in which the world works, is by talking about the consensus. Right? Those people in the know, those who've studied the matter, those who really have spent the time thinking about this carefully. We, 97% of us agree that, you know, global warming, 97% of us agree that Darwin's right, right? Whatever, right? You use the word consensus now in the public media and you get laughed out of court. Right? Because this is part of what the post-truth thing has done. Post-truth has kind of, in a way, arisen to a meta level. The people have risen to a meta level, and they sort of understand that there's an extent to which, you know, those numbers are not neutral. Those numbers are, in fact, motivated by trying to get people to move in a certain kind of direction. And even if it is true that 97% of people believe certain sorts of things, and that they happen to have studied them for a long time, it doesn't necessarily follow that they are in fact correct, especially with regard to the issues that concern the people, right? Because one of the problems that we often have had with the notion of expertise, and this is something the post-truth discourse picks up on, is the idea that expertise, to a large extent, if you think about what expertise is in a strict sense, namely that these are people who've been trained in a certain way to see things in a certain way, something like a Kuhnian paradigm, and they can see the whole world that way, and they're really good at doing it, and they can solve problems in that way. And so they can give you very clear answers once you accept the frame from which they're operating. Right? This is certainly true of economists, if you think about how economic forecasts work well if you accept the premises. And then the question is whether you should accept the premises. Whether these are actually the things you should be actually basing your judgment of the economy on. And expertise works well if you're willing to accept the frame of the expert, right? So again, this is about whose frame you're accepting. Post-truth challenges this. Post-truth says, look, we don't have to accept their frame. What these guys are basically doing is they're doing a bait and switch on you. What they're doing is that they're trying to get you to substitute how you really think the world is for how they really think the world is, and then they're going to solve your problem once you already believe what they're saying. Okay, so I think a lot of the post-truth discourse is about this kind of thing, namely the idea of shifting the frame. And in a way, part of the shift is seen as a kind of correction. This is the other point I want to make. Namely, that the post-truth discourse doesn't come from the spirit of relativism. People, you know, should believe what they want to believe, and so therefore you have your framework, I have my framework. That's not really where the post-truth discourse comes from. It comes from the idea that in some sense, the people who have controlled the frame of the game have betrayed them. Right? That there's a sense in which by portraying the truth and truth production in a more monolithic way than it really is, and by saying that there are fewer range of options than there really are, they have in fact betrayed the public trust. And so what the post-truth discourse is doing is trying to recover that, okay? And the way to recover it is by going to the meta level and changing the rules of the game so the experts don't start with the presumption. Okay? And so this is really quite a different kind of dynamic here from the way post-truth is normally being presented. And it's one that I think one should expect in a period where, on the one hand, we put an enormous amount of authority and weight on the value of knowledge and knowledge production as the basis for decisions in public life, but at the same time, it isn't fully democratized. It isn't fully democratized. There is still a kind of authoritarian structure, a soft authoritarian structure, one in which an increasing number of people may be allowed to enter in and participate in, but it is still an authoritarian structure. And as long as that sort of dynamic exists, you know, at a political and epistemic level, then you should expect something like post-truth to kind of rear itself, and not unjustifiably. Okay, so I'm presenting post-truth here in a relatively sympathetic manner, because I do think, in a sense, the reason why we've got this kind of situation is in a way because people do believe in the value of knowledge. They do believe that the truth ought to be guiding their ways of doing things and so forth. But they feel they have been betrayed because they feel that in some sense the kind of information, the kind of scope for choice has been restricted more so than is necessary. And in this respect, it is not by accident that this kind of move coincides with the period of the internet where you start to see challenges in a very explicit way to established forms of institutionalized knowledge, especially the universities, but also the governments and all the other institutions of society that rely so heavily on universities for their own legitimacy. Okay? Now, and this is where I would like to open the discussion, and I will end here. I would have thought that from a Popperian perspective, this kind of slant, this kind of view that I'm giving of post-truth would be a welcomed one, okay? That this would be a welcomed one. So in other words, even though it is risky, it is dangerous, it is open to all the issues about populism that people are always going on about, nevertheless, generally speaking, this kind of post-truth move is actually one to be welcomed as opening up the sphere of epistemic discourse in the spirit of a kind of democratized critical rationalism. So I will stop my remarks here, because I think, you know, in terms of putting something on the table for people to talk about, because I take it this is the spirit in which you want to have this conference, I will end here and thank you for listening.